The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here. From the studios of the legendary WBAI in New York, to a converted fire station in Chelsea, to a state-of-the-art multimedia studio in uptown Manhattan that is also LEED Platinum certified, the George Polk and Gandhi Peace Award-winning journalist Amy Goodman and her crew have been amplifying movements for grassroots social change around the world for two decades now. Or to string together the titles of her five best-selling books, which she's presented here, Amy Goodman is the exception to the rulers, standing up to the madness by breaking the sound barrier and cutting through the static to give voice to the silenced majority. Amy's brother, David Goodman, also an award-winning journalist and co-author of a number of the aforementioned titles, as well as a contributor to numerous outlets, including Mother Jones, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, will join us first on stage. Please give a warm Philadelphia welcome for David Goodman.
Thank you. It's great to be back at the Free Library, one of our favorite venues. And Andy was actually keeping count, tells me this is Amy's fifth time back, my second time back. So who's counting? Well, someone is. So I thought for many of you who listen to or watch Democracy Now!, it might be helpful, and here we are celebrating 20 years of Democracy Now!, you might be interested to know how Amy Goodman got to be Amy Goodman. Well, as her brother, I can shed a little light on this. I think Democracy Now! Really got its start at our kitchen table. It's really an extension of the lively debates that would go on in our household. The debates ranged from our uncles, they were all, our family were all immigrants from Eastern Europe. We had Uncle Joe, who was the socialist insurance agent, and Uncle Sock, who, believe it or not, Uncle Sock sold socks and underwear on the Lower East Side, who was a devout conservative. And it seemed no matter how many family dinners we had, there was always unfinished business between Uncle Joe and Uncle Sock. And all hell would break loose. The kitchen the table was never flipped over, I'm glad to say. And maybe that's the ultimate message for Democracy Now! The table still stands at the end, but everybody has to sit around it. So in 1995, in December 1995, Amy got a call while in Haiti in a safe house where she was covering an election. In Haiti, as in many places in the world, to be part of the opposition or resistance or simply to vote other than for the ruling party was to take your life in your hands. So Amy was there covering that election. Bullets were flying. Government opponents were taking cover. And she got a phone call from Pacifica Radio. Would she be available and interested to host an election show back in the United States for the 1996 election? This was the election, you may recall, the re-election campaign of President Bill Clinton. He was running against Senator Bob Dole, and a billionaire, a self-appointed billionaire who had announced he was going to save the world. His name was Ross Perot. So when Amy came back to our kitchen table in our house to report this to my parents, they were thrilled. Finally, Amy was going to have a boring desk job. She'd be like Walter Cronkite, you know, the voice of God, just holding forth, telling us who's hot, who's not, who's up, who's down, and it would all wrap up after Election Day, and she could go on to hopefully find another boring desk job. Well, my parents had reason, and I should say something about my parents. My dad was a physician who founded the Long Island chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He was famous in his own special way because his face, his very worried doctor's face, appeared on buses and subways for Physicians for Social Responsibility, holding a stethoscope, and in the little round orb of the stethoscope was a nuclear mushroom cloud. And it said on top, "Your doctor is worried." He always told us that he got a serious headache doing that ad because he had to furrow his brow really hard for like several hours while they worked on this photograph. My mom was a peace activist. She was a social worker, and she was a peace activist. She was also a teacher, an English teacher, which is... and while sadly they are no longer with us, my mom, we wrote our first three books in my mom's house, and the old English teacher in her was our toughest critic and would tell us when we completely missed the mark. I, of course, would always have to remind her, "Mom, you don't have to say we're smart and good-looking anymore. Just tell us when it doesn't make any sense." And so she did. And we have her to thank for hopefully something cogent, coherent, and intelligent to thank in our first three books. So back to my parents' concern. Amy, in 1991... had traveled to East Timor. She was in the news director at WBAI in New York City, one of the great first five Pacifica stations in the country. And yes, everybody should feel free to come on down and make yourself comfortable. We can always make room. She had gone to East Timor. This was a country that few people had heard of, few people who had perhaps not read Noam Chomsky. I think Noam was really the only one writing about East Timor. He talked about a country occupied by Indonesia. This is an island nation about 300 miles north of Australia, where the Indonesian military had moved in the mid-19, an invasion in 1974, had killed one-third of the population and walled it off from the outside world so that no one could tell the story. Well, they weren't counting on my sister Amy to show up in 1991 to pull back that Iron Curtain, to do what she has always said is her motto and her reason for doing what she does, which is to go to where the silence is. And few places on earth were more silent than the people suffering in East Timor. A massacre broke out. She and her colleague, Alan Nairn, who was there reporting with her for The New Yorker, were caught in the crossfire. Alan threw his body on top of Amy to try and shield her. And the soldiers then went at them and began swinging their U.S.-made M16 rifles at Alan's head until they fractured his skull. But Amy and Alan were lucky. They lived, and they lived to tell the story. One of the first things the Indonesians did, as so many repressive regimes do, was to try and silence the journalists. When they invaded in 1974, their first act was to kill five reporters from the Australian Broadcasting Corporations, shot them into the harbor in the capital city of East Timor. So Amy and Alan were the lucky ones. And the reason that they were lucky, Amy has always assumed, is because their weapons were from the same country that Amy and Alan were from, the United States. This was a U.S.-backed occupation carried out with U.S.-made weapons. So back to this boring election show and why my parents were so relieved. Now you have a little of the background of that. Well, interestingly, so Democracy Now! Starts in February 1996, and about 4 months later, I also a journalist, a print journalist, traveled to moved to South Africa with my family, including my daughter Arielle, who is sitting in the front row, now lives in Philadelphia. She was then 4 years old, and we went to live in South Africa under President Nelson Mandela, and I was reporting on the Mandela years and the transformation from apartheid. And the reason that I mention this is that at the same time that Democracy Now! Is starting, I got to see what happens when there is no Democracy Now! I was covering the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which had been established because the South African judiciary system, new and weak, was really unable to bring the big offenders, the big figures of apartheid, the generals, the apartheid generals and such, they're unable to bring them to justice. And so South Africa struck a rough deal. If they couldn't get justice, let's at least get truth. Let's at least get truth. Imagine that. This was a country where there was no consensus about the history, about what had happened just a year ago or 5 years ago. There was no Democracy Now. There was only one side of the story, the white government's side of the story. And, you know, they say that history is told by the victors. And that was in the case. So now in a newly independent South Africa with a President Mandela and a democratic government, they didn't have a history book that told the real story of what had been happening for the last centuries in their own country. And so we come back to Democracy Now! And that kitchen table. We're assembled around the table that you listen to every day are all the voices, and not just the voices of the powerful and the heads of corporations, but the voices of the people who are really making the change. You, the people in their communities, in their movements, around their own kitchen tables, who are coming together to raise an issue of concern. Maybe it's about Black Lives Matter and the fact of African-Americans being killed in their own communities by the police and by vigilantes. Maybe it's the climate change movement. Perhaps it's the LGBT movement. These are the movements that are making change today. And so that's why Democracy Now! Is covering these movements from their very start, so that when you see it on the evening news or read it in the Philadelphia Inquirer today, you know you've already read it or seen it and watched it on Democracy Now! A year ago. It's that kitchen table bringing forth all these voices that lets you know that you are not crazy and you are not alone. And that's what Democracy Now! Has been all these remarkable 20 years, the connective tissue that brings people together, that forges community just by coming over the airwaves and enabling you to hear all the voices that are gathered round. I think of Democracy Now! As the beating heart of these many movements, many of them which may have started in their own silos, their own corners, but this is where they come together and realize they are interconnected. It is one struggle, one issue, and that we are so much stronger together and apart. And Democracy Now! Is part of what enables us to be together. And so I tip my hat to the amazing 20 years. My parents would be more proud than relieved. Amy has not been an easy listening, calm ride. Many of you know she's been arrested at the 2008 Republican convention, detained by the Indonesians when she went back into East Timor after getting kicked out. And then, of course, her most seditious act was when she was detained at the Canadian border, you know, our enemy to the north, where she was driving from Seattle to Vancouver to give a talk at the Vancouver Public Library on the importance of free speech. Yes, that was another time that she had to be thrown into the back room and interrogated. So let's give a warm welcome to the person who I think is the most courageous, compassionate, and essential journalist in America today, my sister Amy.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. David, did you drink from this cup? I just want to say thank you so much. It's wonderful to be at the Philly Free Library and to be here with my brother and co-author of this book, Democracy Now!, and say that without David and Dennis Moynihan, who is not my husband, despite what the Philadelphia Inquirer said yesterday, I just called him and asked him how his lovely wife Trish was and to warn her before he shows her that article that he is not a bigamist. But without David and Dennis, the book never would have been written. With their grace and creativity and way with words, it is just a wonderful collaboration. And in fact, although David is my younger brother, and it's wonderful to see his daughter Ariel here, who works at the station Democracy Now! Broadcasts on here in Philly, Philly Cam, and I hope you all tune in, as well as Mind TV, that it was really David, my younger brother, who was my inspiration for journalism. It was when I was 9 and he was 7, and he started publishing Dave's Press in our house. There were signs to the second floor. His bedroom all said Dave's Press with an arrow. And you'd see him in his room laboring over this old Xerox machine he had gotten where you burn the image from one piece of paper into the next. That's how you made Xerox copies. And it was sort of a glorified family newspaper, family calendar, one part of it. And things like, you know, Mom spanked Amy on this particular date in this particular year. If your parents are wondering how to raise your children, yes, we did get spanked. But my mother would get furious at David and say, you do not air the family's dirty laundry in this newspaper. And then David would cry, freedom of the press. And and the fact he would actually cry because he was 7 years old. And anyway, they put the David put out this publication. But what was most interesting were the editorial pages of the paper, where he would write his editorials against the war in Vietnam. And our greater good person family would weigh in. You know, my grandfather would write, dear Dividel, I am so proud that you are the publisher of Dave's Press. And David would write back, dear Grandpa, I love you so much for being my first subscriber, but your views on war are stupid. And then my uncle would weigh in and he would say, Saul, our grandfather, how could you attack your grandson that way in the pages of a public newspaper? And that's how we hashed out the issues of the day. I was either the envelope stuffer or the treasurer. I'm not sure which. It was like a penny a year. And then I was also inspired by our older brother, Steve, who was a journalist before, well, not before David, because he was the first journalist in the family. But my dad was also not only an ophthalmologist, but he chaired the task force in our community to integrate the schools. They asked him if he would run this. And we would go with him. I was in fifth grade to the auditoriums and cafeterias of the elementary schools, thousands screaming parents because they had moved to their neighborhood to have a neighborhood school. And this task force was leading towards integration, right? We had the proverbial railroad track. So if you had the first grade in one school and the third grade in another, you would have an integrated system. And I'd watch as he judiciously steered our community to a more racially diverse place. He had death threats against him, and he would be in his study with the door closed speaking to people on the phone, and my older brother, who was on the high school newspaper, would have his ear glued to the door. And my father would come out, and Steve would say, I have a scoop. This is perfect. My father would say, what are you talking about, a scoop? He said, well, I just heard what you said. And he said, that was not on the record. And Stephen would say, you didn't say that before you started the conversation. He said, I didn't know your ear was glued. So then he would be chasing my brother out the front door. And Stephen, again, like David, would be saying, freedom of the press, freedom of the press. So that's how, that's the climate we grew up in, where I really saw in high school, being on the high school newspaper, you know, you write an editorial challenging the principal and suddenly the policies would change. And beyond high school, you just take it to the next level and you, you know, take on the president or whoever are the powers that be. And that's really critical. That is the role of journalism. There's a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. You know, this has been a crazy 100-city tour. We're at about city 70, and I'm very glad we got here on time because by the fourth city, we're about an hour and a half late. That was Kansas City in Missouri. And I was saying, my God, if we're an hour and a half late on the fourth city, by the 90th city, we'll be like months late. But Kansas City is a very interesting place. The KKFI was the community radio station we were holding a fundraiser for. It's a radio station that Leonard Peltier used to listen to when he was in Leavenworth. You know, he's been jailed for decades, applying again for clemency under President Obama. He applied under President Clinton. And he used to call into his defense office, where our colleague and co-author Dennis Moynihan was, every day in the morning right after Democracy Now! He said he and the brothers would be in the recreation yard for this 1 hour. They all be huddled around a tiny transistor radio because the warden had issued these regulations that the radio be smaller and smaller. And they would listen to Democracy Now! It was their lifeline to the outside world. And then he just wanted to discuss the issues. And he said throughout the day, the prisoners would discuss what they heard. Then we were in Atlanta, Georgia, and and we were celebrating WRFG, Radio Free Georgia. And they told us about a $325 contribution they got in the fundraising drive, which is really great. But it was greater than that, because that $325 was the pool contributions of 65 prisoners from the maximum security prison who listened to Democracy Now! And just before we left on this tour, we got an email from a prison administrator in England. Now, a year ago, he wrote to ask if they could run Democracy Now!, you know, we're radio and television, if they could run the television version on prison closed circuit TV in England. And we said, of course, you know, we pioneered this way to send broadcast quality video through the internet many years ago. Oh, it's so important we keep the internet open and free. Don't let the video companies and the telecoms privatize this global public resource. So we said, of course. And so right before we left on this tour, a year after he first asked, he wrote to us to tell us that Democracy Now! Had been airing for a year, and they attribute a 50% increase in prisoners enrolling in classes to watching Democracy Now!, that they want to learn more about the world. So here we are, around City 70. We were recently in Berkeley, celebrating the 67th birthday of the first Pacifica station, KPFA. Now, you know, I originally come from Pacifica, which was founded 67 years ago in Berkeley, California, in 1949. A war resistor named Lou Hill, a conscientious objector, came out of the detention camps and said, there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. Not run by corporations that, the late George Gerbner, who was the dean of the Annenberg School of Communications here at the University of Pennsylvania, would say. Not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so KPFA went on the air in 49. KPFK went on the air in 59, the Los Angeles station. 1960, our station in New York, WBAI. And within the first years of operation, WBAI was running a debate between Malcolm X and James Baldwin, the great writer, over the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience, the effectiveness of the lunch counter sit-ins in the South. KPFT in Houston went on the air in 1970, and WPFW in Washington in 1977. That's the Pacifica Network, the Fab Five, and then there's affiliates all over the country. I want to go back to KPFT, that station in Houston in the Petro Metro. It's the only radio station in the country. Went on the air in the spring of 1970. Within a few weeks, it was blown up. The Ku Klux Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens, right in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant. And I thought that was a good song. But anyway, after a few weeks, they got back on their feet. They rebuilt the transmitter, and the Klan blew it up again, with 15 times the dynamite strapped around the transmitter. So now, you know, it's tough. It's going to take them months to get back on the air. And, I mean, the silver lining was it's not like Pacifica had money for advertising. It certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of the people of Houston. I do not recommend this as an advertising strategy. but in January 71, KPFT, that phoenix, rose from the ashes. PBS came in its infancy to broadcast this historic moment. Arlo Guthrie came back to Houston to finish his song live on the air, and KPFT went back on the airwaves. I don't remember if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles, but he said it was his proudest act. I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it is an aunt in Iraq, an uncle in Afghanistan, a kid from the South Bronx or from South Valley, where we just were in Albuquerque, where we spoke at RFK High School, a high school whose population is overwhelmingly undocumented immigrant students. When you hear someone speaking from their own experience, it challenges the stereotypes and caricatures that fuel the hate groups. You know, you might say it sounds like my bubba, my baby, my aunt, my uncle, and I'm not saying you'll agree with them. I mean, how often do we agree with our family members? But it makes it much less likely that you'll want to destroy them. It's that understanding that's the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back. Now, I was just talking about Leonard Peltier, which made me think very quickly about a conversation that I had on the air with someone you might be familiar with in 2000, but let me give you a little background. So Democracy Now! Started in 1996 as the only daily election show in public broadcasting on 9 community radio stations. And we were going to wrap up the day after the election. That was the election of Clinton versus Bob Dole versus Ross Perot. And right after the election, we thought the project was done. But there was more demand for the show after the elections than before because of this hunger for independent media. So it just kept growing. Okay, so it had a little dip in 1997, that next year, because of what happened here in Philadelphia. But we went down to 8 stations. That was because we dared to air the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. You know, he was on death row at the time here in Pennsylvania, and it was actually not our idea. It was National Public Radio, it was NPR's idea. They had this great idea to go into the prison and record commentaries of his. Their editor said they were some of the finest commentaries they'd ever heard on any issue. And they got a lot of publicity. They really pushed forward, to their credit, and say they were going to run these commentaries. But then the Fraternal Order of Police pushed back hard. They were having a national meeting in Washington, and on the eve of them airing these commentaries, they pressured NPR not to run them. And so they locked them away in a safe. So we felt we had to go to where the silence was. We felt it was now our obligation. And we worked with Prison Radio Project, went into the prison, and we recorded new commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We didn't back off. And the first day that we were running the commentaries, we had on mainstream journalist organization, like the Society for Professional Journalists, and they were really commending us, saying, this is our job as journalists. You know, we're not here to win a popularity contest. And especially when you look at the crisis of mass incarceration in this country, and you look at especially during the Clinton years, right, signing off on the 1994 so-called anti-crime law that even President Clinton now says really escalated mass incarceration. How can it be that we have 5% of the world's population but 25% of its prisoners? So it's our job to go behind the bars. And to go behind the bars, the death rows of this country. Mumia does not talk about his own case. He was not making his case, and we invited the Fraternal Order of Police on. But he talks about what it's like to be on death row and in prison. And he would talk about, one commentary was called Father Hunger, about how so many of the young men in prison don't know their fathers and would see him as a father figure and a grandfather figure. And he said, and there he was, not being able to be a father and grandfather to his own kids. He talked about capital punishment being punishment for those without capital and other issues like that. So just as we were going on the air with our first commentary, we were going to run a series of 13 of them. Temple University, which ran the network that ran Democracy Now!, pulled us from the airwaves in the midst of the show. They said that their audience had a desire for more jazz. Now, I took this as a double insult because I am a jazz lover. And they actually wrote to us and said it was inappropriate to air the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And whatever you feel about the case, it is absolutely critical that we have a debate on all sides of the bars on criminal justice. The Society of Professional Journalists was shocked, SPJ. And then, Temple University, the law school, had a major forum. 1,000 people turned out. The dean and the president of the school got like 1,000 emails and petitions from university professors, because this is a university network as well, from journalists, you know, protesting this. And then Jazz FM had a problem because their folio had gone out the week before, and it said that Democracy Now! Was one of the most popular programs, and they saw it as a model for their other shows. So that was landing just as they were saying. They were switching gears midstream because there was a more desire for jazz. And I was very sorry about this, but I felt it was absolutely critical that we forge forward. And then more and more stations picked us up. 2001, September 11th, the day of the horror, 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero. We went on our first TV station in New York, emergency broadcasting, and the show just took off like wildfire. Here in Philadelphia, all over the country. And as soon as we go on public access, the NPR station in a town would say, hey, can we run this show too? We're the only TV radio show, not a televised radio show, but full TV show, full radio show. And so we went from 9 stations in 1996, dipped a little in 1997, and then now we're on over 1,400 public television and radio stations around the country and around the world. Really trying to put the public back into public media. In San Francisco, we're on both PBS stations. Same with Los Angeles and Washington. We're on Howard University's PBS station. You can ask your stations here, NPR, as well as PBS stations, to run the broadcast. So in 2000, it was Election Day. And, you know, it was going to be a long day. We started the show. We had the show, I think, broadcasting at like 9 in the morning. Election Day 2000, that was the day that Gore was running against Bush, right? Gore v. Bush. Bush v. Gore. And the producers had gone into the control room. The show was about to begin, and we got a call. Oh, by the way, that's Ariel giving out the Daily Digest that lets you hook up with our daily headlines. It's a great way to stay in touch. And if you don't want to do it on paper, you can just text the word Democracy Now, one word, to the number 66866, and you'll get a request for your email. You put it in, and you're ready to go. So that's 66866. And also, if you take any pictures or tweet anything or anything today, just use the hashtag covering the movements, and that's how we keep tabs on what's happening in reaction to this tour. So we get a call. It's right before the show begins, and we broadcast every morning at 8. And the producers are already in the control room, and we get a call, White House Communications, and I thought they said White Horse Communications. There's a famous tavern in New York called White Horse Tavern. It's where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death. And I said, yes. I mean, I thought this was an emergency call because we're going on the air breaking news. And they said, the president would like to speak to you. I said, the president of a tavern at 8 in the morning? I said, the president of what? And they said, the president of the United States of America. Oh, White House Communications. Oh, President Clinton? Yes, President Clinton. He's calling radio stations in New York, and they'd like to get out the vote. So I said, oh, really? Well, and the producers are screaming at me to come in. So I said, okay, I'll give you the internal line. I thought this was a hoax. I had no idea what was going on. And I hung up the phone, ran in. I said, okay, guys, from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! It goes to a clip. I said, okay, listen, President Clinton might call, pick up the phone, think of questions for him, but I actually don't think this is going to happen. All that and more coming up. And so the show went on, the hour went, and he didn't call. So anyway, we're going out for coffee, my favorite food, and because it's going to be a very long day. You know, the president will be announced around midnight, 1, 2 in the morning, Bush v. Gore. Hardly, right? It takes 5 weeks. It's a selection by the Supreme Court, not an election. But that's what we're thinking at the time in the morning. So, and we get a call. We hear a shriek from the control room. It's Gonzalo Alberto, who runs the Alternativa Latina music show. He says, the president is on the phone. So we go running in. He has a producer. I have two. And he's paralyzed. He's on the audio board like this. And all the music faders are up. Salsa music is blaring. And all the microphones are down. And you hear President Clinton saying, is anyone there? Is anyone there? And so I had no idea how to control the audio board, but I dove over it, and I brought all the salsa music down, every microphone in the room up, because I had no idea which connected to which. So the room is totally hot. I said, okay, Gonzalo, we're about to interview the President of the United States. Think of questions. So I said, hello, Mr. President. I understand you're calling stations to get out the vote for Hillary Clinton. She was running for Senate, and Al Gore running for president. I said, I understand you're calling stations to get out the vote. What do you say to those who believe that both the Democratic and Republican parties are captured by corporations? And he responded, you know, we got very forceful, and he explained why you should get out and vote. And then I asked him about Leonard Peltier. I said, I understand no one had asked him about this publicly, that you are weighing clemency for Leonard Peltier. What's your decision? And he talked about that. And then we asked him if the U.S. Navy would stop napalming and bombing the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. And then we asked him about the U.S. sanctions against Iraq. Remember the sanctions in the 1990s, the sanctions regime? Remember when Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes asked then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright if, you know, there were 500,000 children in Iraq who died as a result of the sanctions? And Stahl asked Albright, is it worth the price? And she said yes. She later said that she regretted that response. So I said, you know, both UN Assistant Secretary Generals have quit over the sanctions regime, calling them genocidal, and asked him to respond. I asked him about going back to Arkansas to preside over the execution of a mentally handicapped, a mentally disabled man named Ricky Ray Rector, and what message he was trying to send. And then I asked him about, you know, Ralph Nader, who actually is running this big conference in Washington for these 4 days called Breaking the Power at Constitution Hall in Washington. I asked him, you know, he was running for president then, if what he said to those who said that President Clinton was responsible for Ralph Nader's success because he was bringing the Democratic Party to the right. And that got him mad. And he said, I find you hostile, combative, and at times disrespectful. So I said, but they're just critical questions, and I just have a few more. So Vice President Gore, running for president, said his first act in office as president would be to outlaw racial profiling, which is a very good thing. And I said, but you guys have been in office for 8 years. Why haven't you done it until now? And anyway, he responded and then said he had to get off the phone. So it was about a half an hour. It got a lot of attention, half an hour of the President of the United States. And that was the alternative Latina music show on WBAI that day. So the next day, we ran it on Democracy Now! An hour early, and I came off the show into our office, and first thing I got a call from, I mean, this got headlines everywhere, actually, but I got a call from New York Newsday reporter, and he said, how did this happen? How are you interviewing the president for a half hour? And so I said, oh, the other phone is ringing, sorry. This is when we had wired phones, you know? So I pick up the other phone, hello, New White House Communications, and I knew this was the White House this time. And so I said, oh, hi. And so they said, you're banned from the White House. I said, what are you talking about? And so I said, he called me. I didn't call him. And so they said, you broke all the rules. I said, just 1 minute, please. Peter, I'm going to have to go. It's the White House. He said, you do not hang up on me. He said, you put the phone down and don't put me on hold. I'll take care of the rest. Okay. So I only following orders. So I put the phone down and I said, okay, this isn't fair. And so they said, you broke every part of the agreement that we made. I said, agreement? You called me seconds before we were going on the air. We spoke for all of 30 seconds. Half of that time, I thought you were a local bar in New York. What agreement did we make? They said, we told you the president wanted to talk about getting out the vote. And you asked maybe question 1, 4, and 7 related to this issue. But that was it. I said, I asked 3 questions related to what he wanted to talk about. They said, that's right. And I said, I must be falling down on the job. So, and they said, and I said, but it does, I said, it does sound like you have a transcript, and we always, well, volunteers write transcripts of the show every day. If you could send it to us, you could be our volunteer for the day, because we'll post it online, 1, 4, and 7, you know? So they said, this isn't funny. I said, well, I want to know, how many reporters did he call yesterday morning when he called me? And he said, and the woman said, over 40. I said, and every one of them only stuck to asking him about getting out the vote. And she said, that's right. I said, this is a very sad comment on American journalism. And then she said, we also told you he had 2 or 3 minutes. You kept him on the phone for over half an hour. I said, the man is the leader of the free world. He's the most powerful person on earth. He could hang up if he wants to. And she said, I'm not saying he didn't have a good time. So anyway, I got off the phone with her, and then, oh, my God, that other phone. So I said, oh, I'm so sorry, Peter. He says, I got everything I need. Thank you very much. But, you know, we're not supposed to be on bended knee to those in power. We have a special responsibility. And it is absolutely critical that the press corps not be servile. There is a reason that our profession is protected in this country. We shouldn't get arrested when we're trying to put things on the record. We have to be allowed to operate freely. Now, I can't talk about Democracy Now! Without talking about my co-host for 20 years, Mr. Juan Gonzalez. The great Juan, who worked for the Philadelphia Daily News as well in Philadelphia and came to New York. You know, he wasn't always a journalist. He was one of the founders of the Young Lords, which was like the Puerto Rican equivalent of the Black Panthers. And so they would do things like hijack tuberculosis vans in New York to bring them up to the South Bronx so that they would serve the communities that need them. You never had more willing hostage drivers who went into the business because they wanted to serve the community. Or they would occupy churches so that kids would get warm lunches. But then he decided to serve the community in a different way. The editor-in-chief of the New York Daily News begged him to come and be a columnist to offer his unique perspective. And He's been a columnist at the New York Daily News for 29 years until he retired just a few weeks ago. Revered journalist in New York. And we were in the midst of the tour when he was in the midst of the many farewell parties to him. He's teaching at Rutgers now. He will start soon. He's also writing a book teaching journalism. So as I was giving a speech one night and quoting Juan, I'm getting these photographs from the party at the Francis Tavern in Lower Manhattan. And there's a picture of Juan and New York Governor New York Governor Mario Cuomo, then Juan with Mayor Bill de Blasio. Of course, they would not come into the room at the same time because they hate each other's guts. And so they planned, you know, Cuomo came in at the beginning and then gave a toast, and then he quickly left, and then it was all choreographed. And then there was Senator Chuck Schumer and Congressmember Jose Serrano and Geraldo Rivera. And, you know, as I'm looking at all these politicians, my goodness, look at these politicians. I think half of them actually went to the retirement party so that they could verify with their own eyes that finally this guy was no longer going to dog them. But a few months ago, Juan was inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame, and we had the honor of going to Sardi's, my first time there in Midtown Manhattan, our whole Democracy Now! Family, all the staff. Juan was the first Latino journalist inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame, and when he gave his speech, he put everyone else to shame, the other inductees like, oh, Charlie Rose and Leslie Stahl. And as he talked about his quarter century as a columnist, Juan said, "I figured my modest contribution would be not writing about outcast neighborhoods, but from them. Not simply to entertain, but to change, not after the fact, but before it, when coverage could still make a difference." He said, "I've tried to use as many of my columns as possible to probe the injustices visited upon the powerless. Yes, the rich and famous are also victims on occasion, but they have so many politicians, lobbyists, lawyers, gossip columnists, and even editorial writers ready to jump to their defense that they'll always do fine without my help. I prefer the desperate unknown reader who comes to me because he or she has gone everywhere else and no one will listen. More often than not, I come across unexpected gems, human beings whose tragedies illuminate the landscape and whose courage hopefully inspires the reader to believe that there is indeed some greater good served by a free press than just chronicling or influencing the ouster of one group of politicians by another." Now, I just told you about the history of Pacifica. I told you about the Ku Klux Klan blowing up KPFT. But that was a story from 46 years ago. I cannot believe we are talking about the Ku Klux Klan today. I cannot believe we're talking about the Ku Klux Klan in the 2016 presidential election. How is it possible that the presumptive nominee of a major political party in this country, right? Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, when asked by Jake Tapper on CNN if he would disavow support of an avowed white supremacist, right, David Duke, an avowed Klan leader, I can't remember if he was the Exalted Cyclops or Grand Dragon, but David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan, that Donald Trump waffled. He said he'd have to look more deeply into this. When was the last time you heard Donald Trump say he had to look more deeply into anything before he spoke, right? And what is it that he had to do a deep dive on? He had to find out exactly which Klan chapter was expressing its support, because he wouldn't want to generalize to all the KKK chapters in the United States. How is it possible? And you couple that with what's been happening at his rallies. His supporters attacking, for example, in North Carolina, the Black Lives Matter activist who was sucker punched by a Trump supporter. Now, I really don't think that a major candidate who has major rallies is responsible for the behavior of every single person in a rally. I don't think that's true for Bernie Sanders. I don't think that's true for Donald Trump. They're the ones with the huge rallies. But you have to set, you have to set the tone. And if you condemn violence and you say, "I do not accept this," that's your responsibility. Certainly Sanders has done that. Donald Trump, not only hasn't he said that, but he said he would pay the legal fees of, I mean, the guy that, his name was John McGraw, who sucker punched the Black Lives Matter activist, he then said, the Trump supporter, next time he would kill him. And Donald Trump said he would pay his legal fees? I mean, the only silver lining of that one is what Steve Brill, the legal publisher, the legal journalist, said when he heard he said he would pay the legal fees of these violent supporters. He said that's very interesting because he never pays his own legal fees. But this is extremely serious, coupling the violence with the overt racism. I mean, he is ripping open the underbelly of hate in America. He is opening a Pandora's box that is extremely frightening. And we need a media that, especially for young people, that talks about what the Klan was and is in this country. And I know that most people know. You know, you say the Klan and most people know, but really dives into it. Because, I mean, I told you we were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, September 11th, 2001. That horrific moment, 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. We'll never know how many people died on that day because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death, and they're the undocumented workers and immigrants who were in that area. But it was the horror. However, it was not the first time that terror came to U.S. soil. Ask any African-American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. It was horrible, but it wasn't the first time. And the Klan plays an absolutely pivotal role in this, right? How many thousands of African-Americans did they kill, maim, lynch? And we have to tell this story. We have to make clear this history, or it will be repeated. which brings me to last June, the horror that took place in Charleston, South Carolina. You remember, it was June 17th. Donald Trump announced for president on the 16th, and June 17th in Charleston, South Carolina. 9 people killed at Bible study at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. The 8 parishioners and their beloved pastor, who also happened to be a state senator for many years in South Carolina, Clemente Pinckney, he raced back from Columbia, from the legislature, just to be with his flock, his parishioners, for midweek Bible study in the evening. They all knew each other. A young white man walked in. They welcomed him. He was with them for an hour, then he blew them away. Oh, he spared one woman's life and told her she would bear witness and tell the world what he did. A few days later, Dylan Storm Roof was arraigned. And the survivors and the loved ones of the victims put this country to shame when they forgave him. He may well have unwittingly, Dylan Storm Roof, blown the roof off the Confederacy. A few days later, State Senator Pinckney lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda, 2 hours away in Columbia. Thousands streamed by to pay their respects. All the flags in South Carolina were at half-mast, except one. The one that flew proudly and tall on the state capitol grounds, the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag had flown on the capitol itself or the grounds for over half a century. And so the state legislature had to make a very difficult decision. Should they take it down? But they didn't take it down then. They would have to have a debate. I think if most people were asked in this country who led the way, who paved the way, they'd probably say South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. But that's not who took that flag down first. No, it was a young African-American woman, 30 years old, named Bree Newsom. It was 5:30 in the morning on June 27, 2015, 10 days after the massacre at the Emmanuel AME Church. The South Carolina State House glowed in the morning light. Bree Newsom, 30-year-old African-American woman from Charlotte, North Carolina, walked toward the main entrance of the building. She was accompanied by Jimmy Tyson, a young white man from North Carolina, and others who scouted the grounds. They observed the scene around the State House, waiting until there were no guards visible. After about 30 minutes, Tyson and Newsom made their move. They walked swiftly toward the Confederate monument, which stands directly in front of the main steps. The tall monument, topped with a heroic image of a Confederate soldier, pays tribute to those who have glorified a fallen cause, slavery. The two activists proceeded to the 30-foot-high flagpole that stood directly behind the monument. The Confederate battle flag flapped lazily at the top. And then Bree Newsom donned her climbing gear, which she had learned how to use a few days before, and she quickly ascended the flagpole. Guards noticed and began shouting at her to come down. Reaching the top of the flagpole, she grabbed the Confederate flag and unhooked it. She declared, "You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God." She clutched the symbol of the Confederacy and said, "This flag comes down today." She then lowered herself slowly along with the flag. As soon as she reached the ground, Bree and Jimmy were arrested. Video of the protest went viral and was seen around the world. Her bail fund quickly raised more than $125,000. Ava DuVernay, director of the Oscar-nominated film Selma, was among the many to hail her, tweeting, "I hope I get the call to direct the motion picture about a black superhero I admire. Her name is Bree Newsom." Well, but within about an hour, two State House workers raised a new Confederate flag on the Capitol grounds. This is astounding. This is after the mass funeral the day before, thousands packed into the College of Charleston Arena. That's when President Obama sang Amazing Grace. This is after Reverend Clemente Pinckney lay at the Capitol Rotunda, and it's right on the grounds. In fact, this was the day that the individual funerals that were taking place in Charleston. And as the victims were being lowered into the ground, the flag, the Confederate flag, was raised once again. We raced from Charleston, the funerals, to Columbia. We found the jail where Bree and Jimmy were being held. We actually made it into the arraignment cell and saw them charge. They faced, $5,000 and 3 years in prison for defacing state property. We then went out into the lobby of the prison where people were gathering, hoping that Jimmy and Bree would be released. I talked to Tamika Lewis, who'd come with Bree from Charlotte to participate in the action. She said, "To see that flag actually come down and all the things it represents being taken down by a strong black woman was one of the greatest symbolic images one person could ever witness." Another young woman named Carol Parker, African-American woman who lived in Columbia, she had no idea who this woman was, Bree Newsom, but she came to the prison because all she knew is she had spent her life every day walking past that Confederate flag. It humiliated and denigrated her. And she said, "Bree has done what our governor hasn't had the courage to do, what our General Assembly hasn't had the courage to do. She went up there and did what had to be done when it needed to be done." Yeah, shout it from the rooftops. It was Bree Newsom who took down the symbol of the Confederacy in South Carolina. Now, we don't have much time, but I want to quickly go through 1 year and take just a few minutes to do it of activism in this country, because movements matter. I want to take the year of 2011. It started with the Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt, and I think that inspired Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Uprising. On the Wisconsin Uprising, I think the governor, Scott Walker, also had something to do with it because he wanted to bust the public unions. He said he was going to go after the teachers and the nurses, and he assured the police and the firefighters that he wouldn't touch them. Governor Walker's problem was that the police and the firefighters were married to the teachers and the nurses. And so it seemed like the whole state rose up. You had 150,000 people marching in the freezing cold on the state capitol grounds. And inside, they occupied the capitol. I mean, when we flew in, I saw some of the biggest guys I'd ever seen in my life, the Oshkosh prison guards. And I went up to them and I said, "Who did you vote for?" And they said, "Well, Governor Walker, of course." I said, well, what are you doing here? They said, I'm protesting Governor Walker, of course. Outside, an older gentleman, white hair and glasses, had a handmade sign. He's marching through the snow, IRS auditors against Walker. He had a pretty powerful weapon there. And you think about Wisconsin, very interesting place, right? It's the home of the John Birch Society, that racist, segregationist, anti-civil rights, anti-King organization that was co-founded by Fred Koch, who is the father of the oil barons, Charles and David Koch. But it's also the home of AFSCME, founded in 1932, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And as I looked out on the state capitol grounds, 100,000 people protesting across the street was the State Labor History Museum. And I thought about how all these movements coalesce, civil rights movement, labor movement. Think about April 4th, 1968. The day Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis. What was he doing there? He was simply standing with sanitation workers who were organizing a local of AFSCME. And then go back a year before to April 4th, 1967, when Dr. King was speaking at Riverside Church in New York. Thousands of people came to hear him as he spoke out against the war in Vietnam. Even his inner circle said, Martin, do not do this. You've got the most powerful person on earth wrapped around your finger. That's right, you've got Lyndon Johnson. You got him to sign the Voting Rights Act. You got him to sign the Civil Rights Act. This is not your war. Do not alienate him. And Dr. King said, no, the war at home is linked to the war abroad. And he wanted to take on the triple threat of militarism, materialism, and racism. And he stood before the audience of thousands and said that his country, the United States, was the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. He was excoriated by the corporate press. I mean, the Washington Post, I have the Life magazine issue, Time magazine. They said his speech sounded like a script out of Radio Hanoi, that he had done a disservice to his cause, his country, and his people. So he just doubled down, spoke louder and more often against the war until he was gunned down. Then go forward to the summer of 2011. Thousands marching in Washington around the White House, ring around the Rose Garden against the Keystone XL pipeline. 1,200 people get arrested, among them Naomi Klein. We were just in Toronto. Naomi, the Canadian author and activist, it was her first arrest. You should read every book she's written. This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and No Logo, Taking Aim at Brand Bullies. Oh, Bill McKibben was arrested, who founded 350.org, and then moved forward 3 weeks to September 17, 2011, the day thousands of people streamed into Zuccotti Park in New York and occupied Wall Street. The first week, the corporate media did not cover it. You know, there's something worse than negative coverage. It's called the vanishing. And then it was ridiculous. They had to. And so Erin Burnett was just starting out front on CNN then, and her first piece on Occupy was called Seriously. And this is the way the media mocked them, right? They said, who are these people? Like, they can't even make up their mind what they stand for, or what they're camping out for. Like, they're against the death penalty. They're against racism. They're against inequality. They're concerned about climate change. And I thought, oh, my God, they're listening. Yes. All of those issues, like King, they saw them as a seamless web. The media, the corporate media, saw it as their weakness. I saw it as their strength. And they would say they can't even settle on a spokesperson. But it is a leaderful movement, not a leaderless movement. And then, yes, the encampments were eviscerated by the police all over the country. That didn't mean it was the end of a movement. I mean, just look at 2016 and the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who turn out for Bernie Sanders rallies all over the country. Movements have ways of going under the surface and then above, resurfacing. Bernie Sanders did not create this movement, but he is certainly riding it and he's contributing to it, and we will see what direction it takes. And by the way, on this issue of the 2016 election, when I talk about the vanishing when it comes to the corporate media, you can't talk about it enough when you're talking about the coverage of this presidential race. So let me take very quickly one day March 15th, 2015, right? It was Super Tuesday 3. You might all remember it. It was Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. It was when Marco Rubio pulled out because he lost Florida, his home state. Remember Senator Rubio? Yeah. And then it was, and all the media played his concession speech and his withdrawal. And then Governor Kasich had won his first primary, Ohio, his home state, and he gave a victory speech. Remember Governor Kasich? And then Ted Cruz, he spoke, and all the networks, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, they played their speeches, and they should have. Hillary Clinton, she had won North Carolina and Ohio and Florida. She was smart to give her speech after the three because she didn't know what was going to happen with Illinois, her home state, and Missouri. If you remember that night, too close to call, and the networks were saying it, Sanders, Clinton, it would go right into the night. So she gave her speech after her three victories. And then they waited for Donald Trump, and they put up that little square in the right-hand corner of the empty podium in one of his Florida mansions, and they're just waiting for him. You know these pundits on all the networks. You know, I'm invited on CNN to comment, and I say, you know, I can't really single out CNN. I can't tell the difference between CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, because they sound the same when they all play Donald Trump all the time. So they have this empty podium. You know these pundits on all the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. And they're waiting and waiting and waiting, and finally Trump gives a half-hour speech, and they play the whole thing, and then that pretty much wrapped it up, right? Cruz, Clinton, and Kasich, and Rubio, and Trump. There's no one else, is there? Oh, who? Oh, Bernie who? Oh, Sanders. What happened to him that night? Had he fallen asleep? Had he taken the night off? There was not even speculation about where he was. I mean, they were doing wall-to-wall coverage, as they should. None of them even mentioned what had happened to Bernie Sanders. Well, in this 100-city tour, we did a swing through Arizona, and we were in Flagstaff and Tucson and Phoenix. So I know this for a fact because I met many people in Phoenix who attended the Bernie Sanders rally that night. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands, and that by far the biggest gathering that night. And he gave like an hour address. None of them played it or even wondered where he was. Again, it's not even about negative coverage. It's about the vanishing. Don't take it from me. The Tyndall Report looked at 2015. Trump got 23 times what Sanders got. I mean, ABC World News Tonight gave Trump 81 minutes and Sanders got, what, 20 seconds. I'd like to know what Sanders did that was so newsworthy for that year. And then the money that they're raising, all these candidates, it is obscene. Well, interestingly, Sanders is breaking all the records. In March, he raised $44 million to Hillary Clinton's $29 million. He gets it in $7, $9, $27, I think is the average, and over 6 million donors. Hillary Clinton, much smaller number of donors, but they tend to max out, right? The donors of Sanders can go on and on because they're giving so little. It's very significant, and the massive sizes of these rallies. So we were in Laurel Canyon, California, and so was Hillary Clinton, but we were not at her party. She was at a private fundraiser that was thrown by George and Amal Clooney, and the average going amount for a seat at the head table was $350,000. I mean, that was for a couple, but... And even George Clooney was asked about this and on the networks, and he said he thought it was obscene, and he threw the party. But where is, it's not just Clinton, where's all this money going? And why aren't the networks raising it? Well, because the vast majority of money is going to line the pockets of the networks, right? It's going to campaign advertising on television, which is why we need independent media. I mean, you had thousands of people go to Washington following the footsteps of Granny D and Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening. I bet some of you were there. 1,200 people are arrested. And one of the things is people are being dragged away. They're saying, where's CNN? Where's MSNBC? Well, they're pocketing the money. And that's why we need a media that actually questions this critical issue of the corrupting influence of money in politics. So let's go back now. Let's go back to September 17, 2011. September 17th, when people occupied Zuccotti. And then the police ultimately, after months, they wiped out the encampments. If you wonder what happened to this movement, I mean, Occupy occupied the language, right? You say the word 1%, 99%, absolutely everyone knows what you're talking about. You change the language, you change the world. And I want to end by jumping forward to December 2011, to the critical issue of climate change. I mean, right now, in 2016, every month, every record is broken around climate. Just today on Democracy Now!, I mean, how many headlines? You know, you go to democracynow.org. I can't even go to it right now because my phone is so full. It only gives me a white screen on everything I turn to. But anyway, I'll have to deal with that. If anyone knows, when we're signing book upstairs, you can come and help me fix my phone. This is the way we move forward. Oh, and by the way, I just want to say a very quick thing. David and I are going to be signing books, and I'm so thrilled to be with Fox Books once again, to be with this bookshop. You have an independent bookstore in Philadelphia. Many thousands have closed all over the country, and it's also so wonderful to be in this sanctuary of dissent, which is a library, which we so love. Independent bookstores, independent media, libraries, these are the places we hold sacred. So David and I will be signing books. If you get two copies of Democracy Now!, the book, you get a DVD of an interview Nermeen Sheikh and I did with Glenn Greenwald on Democracy Now!, who was the one who met with Ed Snowden. He talks about the coup in Brazil. He lives in Brazil, and he talks about it as a coup. He talks about U.S. government's invasion of privacy and spying on hundreds of millions of people around the world, and he talks about war and peace. Why would you get two books? Father's Day is coming up. You could give one to this library or your own library, wherever you are. But let me tell you something. We're very excited that Democracy Now! Debuted the book on the New York Times bestseller list. This is amazing because the New York Times does not like to mention Democracy Now! So we've had this is our sixth book on the Times bestseller list, so we thought we'd be very explicit. It means they have to print the words Democracy Now! In the pages of the gray lady of the paper of record. Now, but seriously, why does it matter? Not Fox, and I'm not talking Fox Channel, but Joseph Fox Books. But so many bookstores these days, and even libraries, not the Philadelphia Free Library, only stock the bestsellers. It's a problem because great people go into these libraries and bookstores looking for something to challenge their imagination. And they've only got the bestsellers. And we want to be in these places where people go to introduce them to new galaxies and universes of thought, and to provide a roadmap to independent media. And I really do think, you know, media is the oxygen of a democracy, and it's independent media that will save us. But back to December 2011, where I'm going to end. That is when the UN Climate Summit, and those of you who watch or listen to Democracy Now! Know every single year we go to the UN Climate Summit. Copenhagen, then Cancun, then the People's Summit in Cochabamba, Bolivia. And then we went to Durban, and then we went to Doha, and then we went to Poland, and then to Peru, and finally this past year to Paris. And we cover every single day of these conferences, inside and out. And you might say, given what happens inside, why waste the fuel? Because of what happens outside. Because of the thousands of people who come from the most endangered areas of the planet, like the boy 15 years old from the Maldives who comes to the UN summit to say, my country will be submerged. Like the people from sub-Saharan Africa who say, you are cooking our continent. And they're talking to the historically greatest greenhouse gas emitter of all, the United States. And it's not as if we don't suffer extremely from extreme climate change. You've got the Dust Bowl conditions of the Midwest, the fires in California and the Northwest and Oregon and Washington State. You've got the extreme cold in the Northeast. You've got the, 1,000-year flood in Colorado. And you've got Hurricane Irene that almost drowned Vermont. Why don't we understand these are connected? Because the meteorologists on TV that you know, constantly flash those words extreme weather and severe weather, don't flash another two words that say climate change and global warming. It's not just about what to wear when we tune into the weather. It's what we can do about it. Now, in the rest of the world, they have sophisticated debates about what to do about climate change. In our country, the debate is always whether human beings have anything to do with it. The science is settled. It's as if every time we talked about the planet Earth, we brought on someone from the Flat Earth Society for balance. But it was the young people who taught the old, as we wrap up right now, in Durban. In Durban, South Africa, at the end of 2011, there was so much pressure brought by the young people on the outside that they were invited in. Hundreds of them came to the UN Climate Summit World Body, and they chose as their spokesperson a young woman named Anjali Appadurai. David and I were just in Bar Harbor, Maine, at her alma mater, College of the Atlantic, where you get a degree in human ecology. She ascended the stage and said, "I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists, corporate influence, money? You've been negotiating all of my life. You failed to meet pledges. You missed targets. You've broken promises. But you've heard this all before. We're in Africa, home to communities on the front line of climate change. The science tells us we have 5 years max. You're saying give us 10. The starkest betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. Where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science, reason, and common compassion." She said, "There is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Stand with Africa. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation and to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach. 2011 was the year in which the silent majority found their voice, the year when the bottom shook the top. 2011 was the year when the radical became reality." And then she quoted Nelson Mandela, who said, "It always seems impossible until it's done." And she looked out on the vista of faces and said, "So distinguished delegates and governments around the world, governments of the developed world, deep cuts now, get it done." And Democracy Now! Was there to broadcast the voice of Anjali Appadurai, not only in this vast room of 1,000 delegates, scientists, and world leaders, but all over the globe. That's what it is to have an independent media. That's what it is to have a media that cuts through the static, that veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality. When we need a media that gives us the dictionary definition of static, criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. Democracy Now!
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.